Part of interview with M. Rajendra, 31st of December, 1967.
I was thinking that Chinese are also very indisciplined, both in the way they allocate their time and I suppose it's part of management too. You mean people have that concept?
People haven't got that concept. You know, particularly after I think it's part of the British tradition that you entrust the management of the nation to amateurs. But however, you choose your, the process of choosing the amateurs for high political responsibility is well, a strenuous process. It is in the process that people do anyway, the British process before a person can reach cabinet office is matured through various stages of, well, apprenticeship. In Ceylon, you can reach cabinet office with pretty quickly, having not proved your capacity in any walk of life. And having reached cabinet office, sometimes the politicians, both the SNSP and the UNP, think if I can be minister, anybody else can head a big corporation. See, this inclination even, yeah, many have had dealt with the cooperative movement. Well, any half a dozen people elected by a cooperative society can be entrusted with all the responsibilities of big management. I sometimes wonder, you know, the idea of in this day and age with life being more complex and organizations becoming bigger and bigger, and in most countries that are certainly successful in their economic organization, management, the process of choosing managers is done most carefully, and it is appreciated that management is a rare skill, highly paid, and well looked after.
And in fact, there's been criticism of Britain for not being...
not looking after. Well, it's certain that amateur tradition having persisted too long. But as far as Ceylon is concerned, I don't know how long this concept of maybe even the old, you know, a civil service trained in the humanities. One would think is unequal to the tasks of modern economic management. But you find politicians say, you have to be trained in anything. To be entrusted with management and loyalty to party. Is it truly fantastic, you know?
No, I know. On the other hand, it's surprising if you ask the civil servants whether they could manage, say, the Ministry of Industries or Trade and Commerce in particular, something like that. They seem to feel that they could do so. But I wonder, really, whether...
You know,
it's not that they can't. I think they obviously can cope much better than anybody else. But I was thinking, any ordinary person. But I was thinking that someone who's had, say, of course, in business management or being in some big organization.
One of the bigger defects of the class horrible civil service in Ceylon is that nobody stays. Nobody stays long enough in a job.
Thank you.
The result is that every problem is in, no problem gets studied in depth. The government's activities expanding and various people coming and giving different emphasis to what is important. And a transferable civil service has operated in Ceylon is different from the British civil service. In Great Britain, a person selected to the administrative cadre would spend most of his life in one ministry. In Ceylon, he would be one day in the Ministry of Industry, the next day in the Ministry of Commerce, the third day in the Ministry of National Services, and he may be a government agent even soon afterwards. The result is that nobody gets the opportunity to remain long enough in a job to really be competent in the job. And the responsibilities of government now are very different from the responsibilities of government. Say 10 or 20 years ago, the government claims to plan, government claims to determine commercial policy, industrial policy, financial policy. What's been the weakest unit in the government is not the treasury.
Weakest unit?
Weakest unit, completely the weakest unit.
Uh-huh. Why?
Nobody has stayed long enough, and there is no real appreciation in the Treasury of the responsibilities of modern government in fiscal and economic policy. For that you have, certainly if you want to manage money, you have to be highly trained. You have to have a very deep understanding of the working of the monetary system in the country. I think we went through this very sophisticated exercise of devaluation. The decision in itself, I think inevitable, but the subsequent steps we've taken, truly fantastic.
You mean raising the wages?
By legislation of the private sector. Now, again, you know, you have experts in economics at the university. We have very little contribution from them into even contribution to an informed discussion of the problem. Why? Possibly more people with a who in the university is an expert on monetary policies?
Well, there's H.A.D.S. Gunasekar and possibly
Indra Ratna.
I can't assess their capabilities, but
are they theoreticians or persons who applied, who after acquiring theoretical competence have applied their theoretical background to the circumstances of Ceylon?
I don't think they have done that.
They haven't done that.
And even H.A.D.S. wrote on the history of banking rather than anything else, and that.
Yes, his book was on the history of money and monetary policy.
With reference to the Treasury, there is a lot of criticism leveled by newspapermen about their red tapeism and being a block. The impression I get is that is exaggerated.
You see, the point is, again, our newspapers are about the most ill-informed and ignorant any society in this day and age can have. No big organization, commercial or any organization, must have rules and regulations. A government more than a commercial organization, because of public accountability. The Treasury is responsible for laying down the framework. A lethargic public service could treat Treasury regulations, Treasury circulars as divinely ordained. You know, they're guidelines. If you find that they obstruct the carrying out of your duties, you just ignore it. State why you ignore the regulations and go ahead. Government votes you money, government gives you defines a policy and requires you to carry on.
That is the main point, not the regulations.
Not the regulations. Every society, every group, every tennis club must have rules and regulations for the conduct of their business.
This is very interesting because I was arguing this with Neville Jantz.
Yes.
And he was very critical of the system. He said it's not clearly defined and so forth. He's talking about the administrative regulations as well. And he said the system was such that people became slaves to it. But I was prone to argue that...
I think that, you know, recently we wrote a report on administrative reforms of the Prime Minister. And we made the recommendation that a new set of financial regulations was introduced, that the finance minister should state that these are only guidelines in his introduction, and the very officer felt that they obstructed the efficient performance of his duties. He should not hesitate to flout them. But I must say that too many of the public service possibly fall apart of these resistors. They said, well, this, if I take this course of action, this would be contrary to government regulation. And I'll keep quiet. I have had personal experiences of fantastic practice. There is a regulation that states if you want to buy goods, you've got to buy it, goods in common use, through the government stores. Right. There is a in a district, you may find a lorry tire puncture opposite a retailer who has tires to sell. Officer says, I won't operate the lorry, I'll place an indent to the government stores. And possibly for 4 or 5 days, or more, sometimes weeks, the lorry not operated because he's waiting a tire from the government stores. I think such a person would do such. Things ought to be dealt with disciplinarily.
Mm-hmm. In fact, with reference to Treasury control, I presume that the ideal is that it should be merely budgetary control.
Not merely budgetary control. Treasury control is, you see, lays down the rules and regulations regarding correct conduct in the carrying out of government's financial operations. Sometimes they say you've got to call for tenders before you place an indent. Right, because government is so prone to be criticized. If a business firm, you could straight away place an order with anybody whom you think will give you the goods quickest. But even in government service, if you feel that those regulations have to be not observed, you could. But I would say that Neville Jantz's comment is also correct because often the Treasury regulations, you say, write to the Treasury for authority to deviate. Then you may come across an assistant in the Treasury who's hidebound and who's legalistic, who doesn't appreciate the point of view of the man in the field trying to get a jump going, who becomes difficult. That again, I say, goes back to the point that the Treasury has immense responsibilities. They're custodians of the consolidated fund. They are responsible in guiding the public service in carrying out government's economic policy. But persons must be long enough at the job, carefully trained in their responsibilities, if the procedures are going to be properly fulfilled. You know, we, the Treasury, is very much like our constitution, very much a British institution. We have it. But very often, I act in the Treasury now, but I head the Treasury for 6 weeks every year when the permanent head goes away to the World Bank and the Monetary Fund. The feeling I get is that nobody has been long enough in his seat and nobody has a genuine conception of what his responsibilities are. So it is.
I think Neville Jain did make that point that responsibilities were diffuse and vague.
They were very diffuse, vague, and also, you know, what the overall function of the Treasury in a modern democratic society, I don't think has been reviewed frequently enough. In recent years. So now, you know, there is a creation of the Ministry of Economic Affairs, a properly conducted treasury, managed treasury should have performed those functions themselves. So there's a tendency to unload everything on the Ministry of Economic Affairs.
In fact, how has the liaison worked out? It must be rather complicated having these two organizations.
Well, it could have led to considerable amount of conflict, but the fact that the Ministry of Economic Affairs is under the Prime Minister, the Permanent Secretary is Garmini Kore, who is a relative and a confidant of the Prime Minister, smooths out everything, because the Treasury, in every conflict, completely surrenders. And not very, very recently, some of us said the Treasury is only interested in keeping high salaries and not the responsibilities. Because the Ministry of Economic Affairs want to take over any functions, gladly, except if they want to take over any of the highly paid posts, they said, no, we will keep the posts, you take the responsibilities.
But I was wondering whether that means that they could work at cross purposes.
You see, not very much on at cross purposes. They could work at cross purposes if there was an aggressive, positive treasury. But if the treasury is acquiescent in anything that the Ministry of Economic Affairs does, then of course. You see, one of the great power of the Treasury is means whereby Treasury enjoys great powers, that no cabinet memorandum involving any expenditure of funds can be discussed by the Treasury, by the cabinet, without Treasury observations. So that the Treasury has the right to comment on the activities of every single ministry. Now, that power has been extended to the Ministry of Economic Affairs. In a way, it is double delay. Because the Treasury takes its time to study it.
I mean, the obvious solution seems to be to fuse these within one ministry.
No, you know, the problems of, even in the UK, when Labour came into power, they established a Ministry of Economic Affairs. The Treasury was the traditional institution which, in a laissez-faire society, helped government to observe the rules of cautious financial management. When governments take on the responsibility of economic planning and promoting economic growth, then I think it is necessary to devise other institutional devices to undertake those responsibilities. You know, in a mixed economy, you have to, if you want to promote economic growth, it is not merely the planning of government expenditure. It is the planning of the private sector. It is the role that the private sector can play in giving the economy a boost. So I would agree that it is necessary to have two institutions because the responsibilities are becoming much wider, but not in the way that they are operating in Ceylon.
Can't they have two institutions under one head?
Oh yes.
With two important subheads, you know what I mean?
Yes. For instance, under the Conservatives, they had a Treasury performing the functions. The Conservatives themselves in the UK, under Macmillan, started this National Economic Development Councils. And very largely, it was a Treasury responsibility and a Ministry of Trade responsibility. But you want a fairly dynamic Minister of Finance. One would say Mr. Malinayak, a very dynamic personality. And again, whether the rest of the cabinet would acquiesce in the controls that restrains that the Treasury or the determination of priorities in economic planning by the Minister of Finance. So it is, I think, inevitable that if government actively endeavors to promote economic growth and planning, that there should be a Ministry of Planning and that it should come under the dynamic leadership of whoever is acceptable to the country and the cabinet.
So this business of having two institutions could be complicated and tend to slow things down if one looks at it from the point of view of, say, a particular company in the private sector. They might want certain things done. I heard this complaint of some project and which a company put forward, and they had to go to three different ministries and explain it and get permission from three different ministries.
Yes. You see, when the state imposes controls on foreign exchange, licensing of business, it becomes a complicated, disastrous affair. It slows down everything. But the creation of the Ministry of Economic Affairs has only created another little bottleneck.
Yes, that's what I mean.
There is. But that seems inevitable. They say the same thing about India. They say this. You know, planning can be of. Our planning has become much more complicated because of the fact that of this foreign exchange scarcity and the allocation of licenses for importing. Say the French planning, and to a very large extent the British planning, it is more indicative that where all sectors of the economy, the private sector, the trade union sector, the government sector, get together and they endeavor to forecast the correct lines on which the economy should expand. And to a very large extent, they leave it to the private sector and the government to make their independent decisions. And they are not hampered by any licensing system. Maybe to give point to government's indication, there may be fiscal and financial incentives. For instance, they want regional development in Britain, and they give certain fiscal incentives. They may give, if they want the promotion of certain industries, they may give certain fiscal advantages, but they do not go to detailed licensing. But because of our acute shortage of foreign exchange, we have the embarrassing difficulties of licensing. And of course, if we hadn't the foreign exchange difficulty, the question of tax incentives could be easily operated. Anybody who participates in undertakes a new industry would get the benefits of tax concessions. But here, the numerous applications, and you have to choose, you have to license. Then of course comes the whole question of priorities, pressures,
wire pulling,
everything. And the more restrictions you have, more licensing you have, the more corrupt society becomes.
But is there any alternative?
I don't think in our present financial circumstances, our acute shortage of foreign exchange, there is no alternative except a conscious effort to streamline governmental procedures. I was reading an interesting article, Singapore, which has been able to attract a very considerable amount of foreign capital. They have got what they call an economic development center. In one building, you could contact all the governmental authorities to get both information and permits. Of course, the write-up of...
was obviously favorable.
It was a handout by government.
Yes.
Whether it works in reality, but the results that they said that they have been able to attract something like 60 to $100 million of American capital in 18 months seem to show that it apparently does work.
But isn't it ironical now, take the Economic Affairs, Ministry of Economic Affairs, it's supposed to speed up development and boost our economy, but just by imposing this institution in the manner which they have done, they are adding another bottleneck to the general series of controls.
In fact, our Ministry of Economic Affairs does nothing very important besides preparing a foreign exchange budget. And in the preparation of the foreign exchange budget, they do determine priorities. Their most important function today, they write up all the activities in the remarkably good economic journal, is really the preparation of a foreign exchange budget. As long as we have this acute shortage of foreign exchange, they have to play that role.
Mm-hmm. Going back to treasury control and the question of slaves being slaves to a system, I have a feeling that part of the responsibility lies with the public servants of the past, in particular, and the present, who have followed certain precedents. And even corporation heads. For instance, it would seem that the permanent secretaries had certain financial powers and could take decisions on certain matters. But in practice, they have tended to become a post office and pass the things on to the treasury.
The wide delegation of power to the permanent secretaries was very largely the outcome of the report we prepared and got coupled to accept early in 1966, the new financial regulation, delegate white powers. But departments themselves are not aware of those powers, often are reluctant to make the decisions, and they prefer. You know, decision making is not something that everybody welcomes. They prefer to pass the buck on. Unfortunate habit of the Treasury is, instead of saying, no, this need not come to us, there is a little jack-in-the-box in the Treasury will sit on it for 6 weeks without knowing whether he should make a decision, what decision should be made, or the paper should be returned immediately. This is your responsibility. Why send it to the Treasury? If we could operate on the basis that the Treasury refuses to tender advice on an issue which can be decided elsewhere, then I think government business could be transacted much faster. But again, one often gets the impression that government is not interested in efficiency. Government is not interested in getting on with a job of work.
Government being civil service or the...
You know, civil service only reflects the attitude of ministers. The civil service does not generate an attitude of its own. It generates the attitude of the ministers. It just reflects the attitude of the ministers.
And with reference to the ministers, haven't there been several whose attitude is bird in hand is worth two in the bush, and what's the single easy name for that? The one which Kotlawala often used, if you've got a spoon in the hand, you might as well use it to your advantage.
But, you know, although governments in Ceylon have talked of economic planning and whatnot, no group of ministers have ever given serious thought to an economic plan, committed themselves to it, and been prepared to exercise the restraints that are required to implement a plan. That is, if an idea strikes them in relation to their ministry which is contrary to the plan, they go ahead and do it. Certainly, since the 10-year plan was produced in 1958, possibly prime ministers have read the plan in full, but I have never come across a minister that read the plan, even the sections relating to his own ministry. Just not interested, he said, this thought. Theory, we must get on with the job. To get on with the job is to satisfy the pressure groups.
What about the general caliber of ministers and MPs today? Has it deteriorated, or is it the same as, say, in DSN Nair's time?
Possibly the highest quality of members of the legislature that I can think of is the old State Council, where the great majority of them were either professional men or men with a university background. But thereafter, the quality has been the men who had roots in the countryside. UNP had a landowning group, well-to-do landowning, not necessarily educated landowning. Educated, well-to-do. But more and more, it is people who have roots in the countryside who have popular contact. Take for instance two ministers who the UNP have, Mr. Mohammed, Mr. Sugat Das, my minister. They are municipal politicians, so very close contact with the populace. So, you know, the self-made local government politician is a remarkably self-confident individual. There is no regard for theory, there is no regard for learning. He thinks, I know how to manipulate the voter. I know how to remain in power. So placate the influential groups, and that is the function of government. It is democracy also has to have not merely the caliber of men in parliament, but also other institutions which make it work well. That is, most important is an informed public opinion, a critical press. Certainly the quality of our newspapers has over the years, I don't know whether I'm becoming more critical, deteriorated, I should state, think. There isn't a, certainly in economic matters, affairs, they're neither informed nor intelligent. Terrible deterioration in certainly standards of conduct in public life, in public appointments, in promotions in the public service. Well, that is terrible deterioration.
This question of controls and the complications it has caused in a mixed economy might be used as an argument to support what the Marxists say, namely that you can't have a mixed economy, you have to go the whole hog. It might be easier to implement your policies then.
Yes, a completely centrally controlled economy. But in the circumstances of Ceylon, is it a possibility if such complete dependence on world markets? You know, a huge country like Russia or China, self-sufficient to a very large extent themselves, with immense natural resources, can be centrally controlled. And I don't know whether totally controlled priorities of the real priorities. Even Russia is resorting to the market forces to determine their priorities. But for a small country in isolation, I don't know whether we could. Particularly with our pattern of trading. You know, our system of government is possibly the most complicated because we have political parties, the opposition, the government. There's no consensus as to what is the objective, economic objective of government or... The Marxists have never explained, for instance, how they're going to maintain the maximum of social services, and yet accumulate sufficient capital for investment. They have a very happy role, they can always criticize. But how are they going to accumulate resources for investment? The problems of government possibly would become less difficult if there is a consensus among all political parties as to how economic growth is going to be promoted and what resources are going to be allocated to welfare and what resources are going to be allocated to investment. But we have no consensus on that. Even the UNP, when in opposition, criticized Felix Kaas-Bandaranaike when he proposed a cut in the rice ration. If the UNP were wise and expectations were ruling, they would have kept quiet. He was making the unpopular decision.
With reference to the relations between permanent secretaries and ministers, hasn't there been some sort of friction caused by the fact that in many, many cases the permanent secretaries are obviously of higher intellectual caliber, and even if they try, I mean, not to show it, sometimes it obviously be evident, and the minister might suffer from inferiority complex as a result.
You know, few politicians suffer from inferiority complex. They have amazing, abounding self-confidence. In the 10 years that I've been a permanent secretary, possibly IQ of my minister has not been very great, but our relationship has been extraordinarily cordial on the basis that I work on the basis that I am paid to tell my minister what I think is correct according to my highest lights and the best information that I could accumulate on the subject. However, he is elected to rule. If he rejects my advice, it's no personal reflection. I tell him that at your peril, make your own decision in writing, I shall carry it out. But if you take responsibility, and I am recording that I did not agree with this decision. There are no hard feelings on them. I personally have had no hard feelings with any minister.
The Marxists argue that, not in the Marxists, sometimes the press too, have implied that most of the higher echelon in the civil service are UNP oriented. And I wonder how far this is valid. Or whether the implication is that it affects the performance of their duty under non-UNP governments.
I would say that this criticism has been made of the establishment even in the UK by the Labour Party. That is, that the permanent civil service, more so in the UK than here, good university education, comfortable standards of living, coming from middle class homes, are inclined to have the views of the conservative element in society, the state bourgeois element in society. But I think to a large extent it is true that the higher echelons of the civil service have not kept themselves abreast of trends of economic thought, and therefore have not been of very great help in the making of sound economic policy. I won't say that they have been obstructive of any, obstructive in the carrying out of any policy that government determines, whatever the government in power. They may not be enthusiastically in support of, but they may not be enthusiastically in support of, but they won't carry out them and translate into directions, policies, which the government determines.
But it would seem that those who raise this criticism want enthusiastic people, people who agree and put their heart into it. And secondly, it's also argued that in executing some policies, invariably you are also interpreting them. And therefore, you must be in full sympathy.